Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 24th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week features Joe Biden. It's actually two Joe Bidens. They are wearing shorts and tank top t-shirts. It's a track scene. Looks like a relay race. The one smiling Biden has a shirt that says Biden Harris 2020, and he's handing off the baton to another Biden that says Biden 2024. And on the side is the Democratic donkey in a track suit looking at a stopwatch and holding a clipboard. The headline is the 2024 handoff. Will an aging Biden be the Democrats' best and only option? I believe that shows up as the controversy of the week. We will start with the first main story. Downed mystery aircraft, likely benign. What happened? Three unidentified objects that President Biden ordered U.S. fighter jets to shoot down appear to be benign and not connected to a Chinese spy balloon shot down the previous week, the White House said this week. Intelligence officials are considering as a leading explanation that these could just be balloons tied to some commercial or benign purpose, said National Security spokesman John Kirby. Last Friday, the military shot down an object the size of a small car over the Arctic Ocean near Alaska. The next day, an American F-22 with the North American Aerospace Defense Command downed a cylindrical object over Canada's Yukon Territory. Then on Sunday, an object described as an octagonal structure with strings hanging off it was shot down over Lake Huron in Michigan. All three flew at altitudes that posed a threat to civilian aircraft and were destroyed out of an abundance of caution, said U.S. officials. The incidents came days after the military shot down a Chinese spy balloon after it spent days crossing over the continental U.S. Efforts to recover debris from the three most recent unidentified objects have been hampered by severe weather and remote terrain, Kirby said. U.S. officials said they'd retrieved significant debris such as sensors and other electronics from the Chinese balloon, which went down off the South Carolina coast. The craft appears to have been collecting electronic communications, officials said. The Washington Post reported that intelligence analysts are examining the possibility that China intended for the balloon to spy on military installations in the Pacific, and then it was blown over the U.S. mainland by strong winds. Analysts suspect that the ensuing crisis may have been at least partly the result of a mistake, the Post reported. What the editorial said. After four sky shootdowns in 9 days, only one thing is crystal clear, said the New York Post. The Biden administration needs to be more forthcoming, or conspiracy theories will run rampant. Do spy balloons routinely enter our airspace? Why is the U.S. shooting them down now and not before? After briefings this week, congressional lawmakers from both parties called for greater transparency. Team Biden needs to explain what the hell is going on. Despite all the unknowns, the known unknowns, the White House is clearly trying to be as transparent as possible, said the Washington Post. Biden this week tasked an interagency team with studying how to best detect, analyze, and respond to unidentified airborne objects and assess the security and safety risks they pose. Clearly, not every balloon that appears in the sky over North America needs to be fired upon by a costly missile. What the columnist said. This much is clear. The U.S. is finding more things in the sky because it is looking for more things, said Juliet Kayyem in The Atlantic. The Chinese balloon incident led military officials to recalibrate radar and other detection systems to capture slower-moving objects they used to ignore. Because the first balloon does appear to have been a spy mission, it lowered the Biden administration's standard for shooting stuff out of the sky. In most cases, these objects will turn out to be false positives, errant scientific balloons, and commercial gizmos posing no threat. People need to get a grip on reality, said Michael Tomasky in The New Republic. Earth's orbit is filled with exquisitely sensitive spy satellites, with more than 5,400 surveilling every inch of the globe every second of every day. China can watch you sitting in your backyard, and has been able to for years. So why the hysteria? This is a phony national security crisis created by Republicans to make Biden look weak and befuddled. Biden's response really does look incoherent, said Noah Rothman in commentary. His administration did nothing as the Chinese balloon drifted toward and then entered U.S. airspace, but now is turning the skies into a live fire zone and downing unknown objects with missiles. In response, an embarrassed Beijing is reportedly looking for objects in its airspace that it, too, might blow up. With two superpowers eager to take aim at each other's assets for nebulous reasons, there's reason to worry that this balloon farce could take a dark turn. Controversy of the week. Biden, should he hand off the baton? As 2024 looms into view, the Democratic Party sits on the horns of a dilemma, said Laura Washington in the Chicago Tribune. On one hand, President Joe Biden has accomplished more in his first term than any liberal dared hope. And though at 80, he's now the oldest president in U.S. history, he came across as vital, energized, and agile at last week's State of the Union address, especially in his strategic sparring with Republican hecklers. Factor in low unemployment and dropping inflation, and the man who campaigned as a bridge to the next generation of Democratic leaders has suddenly quieted the intra-party chatter about finding a younger candidate for 2024. Let's finish the job, Biden said 10 times during his speech. Clearly, a test run of his 2024 campaign motto. But while the party establishment is warming to the prospect of a second Biden run, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic, voters are still not buying it. His approval ratings remain anemic, and a new Washington Post ABC News poll found only 31% of Democrats want Biden to run in 2024. Call it the Democrats' catch-24. Absent any plausible alternative, Biden feels obliged to run again. But as long as he's running, it's impossible for any alternative to arise. Biden has been a great president, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, and he'd have plenty to run on, rescuing the economy from the pandemic, passing a bipartisan infrastructure bill, a major new investment in green energy, and rallying NATO to support Ukraine against Russia's brutal invasion. Still, he should acknowledge his advancing years and step aside. If the GOP chooses Donald Trump, who will be 78, Biden's age might not matter. But against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who will be 46, the visual contrast alone could be devastating. Why take that risk when Democrats have a deep bench of younger candidates, including Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia, who have shown they can win in the purple states that decide elections? Two people is not a deep bench, said Jason Linkins in The New Republic. Warnock is too green, and Whitmer hasn't indicated any interest in running. Other potential candidates include some unseasoned governors such as J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders, both very old themselves, and a list of 2020 retreads like Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, whom voters already rejected in favor of Biden. Let's be honest, said Dave Seminara in City Journal. The core of Democrats' angst is the Kamala Harris problem. Concerns about Biden's age are magnified by the fact that his vice president has proved to be an empty suit with an approval rating even lower than his own. Harris should be Biden's obvious successor, but she's not. That's why Biden is likely to head the Democrats' 2024 ticket again, said Ed Kilgore in New York. Yes, there's a risk in renominating an octogenarian who doesn't even excite Democratic voters, but it's an even bigger gamble for Democrats to squander precious time, resources, and unity on the carnage of a crowded primary, while Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis waits to pick up the pieces. A nasty primary might split the party along lines of race, gender, and age at a time when Democratic coalition couldn't afford any self-inflicted wounds. Like it or not, the odds of Biden stepping aside are very low. It was a good week for novel legal defenses after a California man successfully beat a DUI charge by claiming his wife had just caught him cheating on her. Thomas Houston's lawyer explained to the jury that drunk driving was necessary to allow him to escape two angry women. It was a good week for F-bombs after a British tribunal ruled that a manager had not harassed a worker by saying during a meeting, "I don't give a F." Those words, the panel said, are fairly commonplace and do not carry the shock value they might have done in another time. It was a good week for proof that the past is not even past, after an archaeologist armed with a metal detector unearthed a 10-pound unexploded shell at the Civil War battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. The shell, later detonated by a bomb disposal team, could have easily killed a dozen people, said a park spokesman. But it was a bad week for Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, founder of the Soviet Union, after a man suffering from alcohol-induced psychiatric disorder tried to steal his embalmed corpse from its mausoleum in Moscow's Red Square. It was a bad week for he/him, with the Church of England's announcement that it will form a commission to study the use of gender-neutral language in referring to God. A church spokesperson said that Christians have recognized since ancient times that God is neither male nor female. Finally, it was a bad week for sleep hygiene after Donald Trump lawyer Tim Parlatore claimed that the former president was using one of the classified document folders found at his Mar-a-Lago estate to block the light from his bedside telephone so he could sleep at night. It's one of the more humorous aspects of this whole thing, Parlatore chuckled. This week's briefing is a game changer for weight loss. A new generation of breakthrough drugs promises to revolutionize the treatment of obesity, but there are concerns. What's the excitement about? For decades, researchers have chased a drug that could significantly reduce weight without dangerous side effects. Now they say that moment has arrived. A pair of drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, different formulations of the compound semaglutide, have shown stunning effectiveness in helping people lose weight by suppressing their appetites. In a 15-month study by the manufacturer, the Danish company Novo Nordisk, obese people shed an average of 15% of their body weight, losing an average of 35 pounds each. They also lowered their blood pressure, cholesterol, and inflammation markers. A newer drug, tirzepatide, marketed by Eli Lilly under the name Mounjaro, has fared even better. In a study, users lost an average of 21% of their body weight. The revolutionary nature of non-invasive treatments that yield results comparable to gastric bypass surgery can't be overstated, said doctors. It indeed is the transformative breakthrough, said Matthias Schopp, a German physician and obesity researcher. The market for these drugs, doctors and weight loss specialists agree, will be massive. How many people might take them? Tens of millions. Some 40% of Americans are obese, while another 30% have enough excess weight to elevate the risks for heart disease, cancer, and osteoarthritis. Morgan Stanley projects that blockbuster global sales of the new drugs will surpass $50 billion by 2030. Soaring demand for the drugs has already led to shortages, driven in part by an explosion of enthusiastic social media chatter. The hashtag, #Ozempic, has generated more than 700 million views on TikTok. So far, only Wegovy has gotten FDA approval for treating obesity. Ozempic and Mounjaro are currently approved only for treating diabetes, but are being widely prescribed off-label for weight loss. How do the drugs work? They are taken weekly in self-administered injections through a pre-filled pen like those used for insulin. In the body, the drugs mimic hormones naturally produced in the intestines that regulate blood sugar and hunger. Semaglutide mimics a hormone called GLP-1, while tirzepatide impersonates that and a second hormone, GIP. By sending signals of satiety to brain receptors that govern appetite, they give people a feeling of fullness after small meals and can make once torturous cravings vanish. It used to be that if I saw food, I would want to eat it, said Rachel Graham, a 54-year-old in Carlsbad, California, who lost 40 pounds on Mounjaro after years of failed diets. Now, if I have three or four bites, I don't want to eat more. Are there downsides? Possible side effects include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and a racing heartbeat. Doctors say they're not common and improve with time and dose adjustments, but those who've had them say they can be debilitating. I had no energy, constant nausea, and what I call power puking, said Anna Tunk, a podcaster in New York City who abandoned Ozempic. Since the drugs are new, it's unknown if there are long-term effects. And because patients who go off them typically gain their weight back, the drugs are likely a long-term and even lifelong proposition. That compounds another problem, the cost. Wegovy runs over $1,300 a month, Mounjaro close to $1,000. That puts them out of reach for many consumers, and insurance often won't cover them. Why not? Previous generations of weight loss drugs have checkered history, and insurers have shared the longstanding view of obesity as a failure of willpower rather than a medical condition. That view is changing in the medical community due to a mountain of evidence that body weight stubbornly resists change, and that for most obese people, dieting and exercise produce only temporary weight loss. We now understand obesity isn't a character flaw, said W. Scott Bush, an obesity medicine specialist at the Cleveland Clinic. It's a dysfunction of the complex system that controls body weight. He and other experts hope the new drugs will lead to insurance changes. But given the number of potential users, the price tag for drugs like Mounjaro could be staggering for private insurers, Medicare and Medicaid. Obesity experts say there are other reasons the miracle drugs give them pause. What are the concerns? Doctors worry that if a weekly shot can produce weight loss, people will dismiss the need to exercise and improve their diets. Advocates for fat acceptance fear the drugs will increase stigma around weight and pressure overweight people to conform to a punishing social standard of thinness. Another concern is that the drugs are already being used by people who are not obese, but have seized on them as an easy way to shed 5 or 10 unwanted pounds. Such worries, though, are outstripped by excitement about the drug's transformative potential. Medicines that can help patients shed 30 to 50 pounds or more are a game changer, said John Buse, an endocrinologist at the University of North Carolina Medical School. Obesity is on the ropes. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with one by author Margaret Atwood, written in The Atlantic. Ban my book? Go right ahead. Today's self-appointed moral gatekeepers want to ban my novel, The Handmaid's Tale, from school libraries, said Margaret Atwood. Go ahead. It'll only make them want to read it more. The school board in Madison County, Virginia, just deemed the book unacceptable and removed it under legislation signed by Governor Glenn Youngkin last year, enabling parents to censor reading materials they found sexually explicit. Focus on the Family, a conservative Christian group, put The Handmaid's Tale on a list of books to be banned. The banning helps answer one of the book's central questions. What kind of a totalitarianism might the United States become? The novel portrays a future dystopian society ruled by a patriarchal religious cult based on heretical interpretations of the Old Testament, with women and their bodies under the total control of the state. Are high school students really too young to explore such questions? Book banners will soon discover that in this digital era, it's even harder to control what young people get their hands on. In TikTok's book recommendation sub-community, The Handmaid's Tale has 400 million mentions. Declaring the book forbidden will make it even more popular. So thanks, censors. The threat of Christian nationalism. More than half of all Republicans harbor a set of extreme beliefs at odds with pluralistic democracy, said Jennifer Rubin, a public religion research institute. Brookings Institution survey published last week sheds light on Christian nationalism, a troubling anti-American movement that is now a major force within the GOP. The survey asked participants whether they agreed with such statements as, being Christian is an important part of being truly American, and God has called Christians to exercise dominion over all areas of American society. More than half of Republicans either mostly or completely agreed. 7 out of 10 Christian nationalists agreed with great replacement theory, the belief immigrants are invading our country and replacing our cultural and ethnic background. Half agreed that we need a leader who is willing to break some rules to set things right. And 40% said that true patriots may have to resort to violence. These beliefs are not tied to Donald Trump and can be transferred to any politician with an authoritarian, racist, dogmatic message. In coming years, defenders of democracy will have their work cut out for them. This column comes from Turkey. Erdogan faulted for chaotic response to quakes. The earthquakes that are already being called the disaster of the century have revealed the incompetence of the century, said Nakati Ozkan. The twin massive quakes that struck on February 6 killed more than 30,000 people and injured some 80,000, a staggering toll. But the pressing need now is to help the hundreds of thousands of people made homeless whose apartment buildings lie smashed in ruins. Those families are now living in tents, freezing in the winter cold, asking why they have been left without food and water. And where is the government? President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling Justice and Development Party established the Disaster Management Authority in 2009, and it was supposed to spring into action. Instead, it foundered, leaving thousands of lives in the rubble that we could have possibly saved. The government has finally ordered universities to close so dorms can be used as emergency shelters, but far more is needed. Rescue operations were hampered by snow, blocked roads, broken glass, fires, and by Turkey's tough guy president, said The Age in an editorial. Caught flat-footed by the quake, Erdogan was initially conspicuous by his absence from the disaster zone. When he did visit the region, he made characteristically grandiose and implausible declarations, saying that the situation is under control and promising to rebuild every building within a year. Erdogan is used to strong-arming losses into wins, but with the earthquake, his spinning plates came crashing down. In a crisis, Turkey needs real leadership, not performance. To stifle criticism, Erdogan even briefly knocked Twitter offline a few days into the search and rescue operation, said Füsun Sarp Nebel in T24. For 12 hours, an essential tool people were using to call for help and track down loved ones disappeared. The government claimed it blocked the app to prevent disinformation, but everyone knows the real reason was to prevent stranded earthquake victims from airing their grievances. With an election approaching in May, it seems our president preferred to restrict social media in a crisis to avoid losing more votes. What this earthquake has revealed, said Ergin Yıldızoğlu, also in Cumhuriyet, is how devastating it is to have all authority centered in one person. Erdogan has been in power, first as prime minister and then as president, for 20 years. And during that time, he has gutted the bureaucracy. His Justice and Development Party is essentially a form of political Islam, and it had tried to remake Turkey as an Islamic republic, jettisoning the pro-Western vision of the country's founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. The Kemalist classes, the competent bureaucrats and technocrats, were purged, as were the liberal intelligentsia. Indeed, tens of thousands were actually imprisoned in the wake of a 2016 coup attempt, accused of being part of a vast conspiracy. In their place, the cadres of political Islam, loyal to the leader but hostile to science and education, have settled in the state. And now when disaster has struck and we need officials to organize a whole-of-government response, there is nobody capable left. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, Searching for the Lost. For decades, Johnny Webb spearheaded efforts to find U.S. soldiers missing in action, said Brian Bender in Politico, and reunited 3,000 with their families for a proper burial. If you are a close relative of a soldier or a sailor or a Marine, or a pilot who is still missing in action, there's a good chance you've sat across the table from a tall, mustached man with a light Texas drawl looking for answers. At the first such meeting, he would more than likely have soberly recounted the circumstances of your loved one's disappearance in battle. He would have cautioned you about the numerous obstacles to locating your relative's remains, the passage of time, the perilous terrain, the lack of records on cooperative foreign governments, or an apartment block now standing where the battle or plane crash happened. But he would also have assured you that every possible lead was being pursued to try to solve the cold case of your missing father or brother or uncle. Over the years, you might have had so many of these conversations with this man that you came to know him on a first-name basis, even added him to your family's Christmas card list. Because if anyone representing the American government was going to bring you and your family closure, it was likely going to be Johnny. For nearly half a century, Johnny Webb has been the heart and soul of the Pentagon's effort to put the pieces back together for thousands of families whose loved ones were taken prisoner, killed in action, or buried in an unknown grave and never got their proper homecoming. Though approximately 80,000 U.S. service members are still unaccounted for, the team Webb built at what is now the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency has located and identified and returned to their families for a proper burial the remains of more than 3,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines from far-flung battlefields as far back as World War II and as recent as Iraq. He has also been the personal emissary of a government that asked its citizens to risk making the ultimate sacrifice, but couldn't always fully honor that sacrifice. He has crisscrossed the United States, logging more than 3 million miles on one airline alone, sharing with families the latest on their loved ones' cases. Whether the news was good or bad, or there was none at all, just more promises to keep searching, Johnny delivered it, face to face. Most recently, and quite possibly for the last time, Webb, 77, performed the ritual on a gloomy weekend in September at a DoubleTree hotel in Denver that drew 164 relatives related to 89 MIAs. There were many familiar faces, like the family members of Air Force Captain Michael Lee Kligner, who took their seats around a table in one of the partitioned ballrooms. There was his widow, Jane Adams, who has never given up hope of finding the remains of her first husband since his F-100D Super Saber was shot down over Laos on April 6, 1970. There was his older brother, Tom, and sister-in-law, Andrea, and Marty Russell, Klingner's best friend from high school in Nebraska. They were joined by a pair of Pentagon analysts armed with reports, charts, and maps. And, of course, Johnny. "I won't let you off the hook," Jane Adams ribbed him. "You don't have to remind me of that," Webb chuckled. "I know you have my phone number. It's on your speed dial." "So you can't retire," was her rejoinder, setting off a round of laughter. But he has. A few months after the Denver meeting, Webb cleaned out his office at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickman in Honolulu, where the facility he helped build and ran for more than a decade as an Army officer has evolved into one of the most advanced forensic laboratories in the world, regularly pushing the boundaries of DNA research. Yet the Texas farm boy has always considered his most sacred duty to be consoling the grieving mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandchildren, nephews and nieces, who are still seeking closure all these decades later, taking their calls at all hours, keeping them regularly informed, and promising that their loved one would not be forgotten. Even the relatives of Vietnam-era MIAs, who have been among the harshest critics of the Pentagon's effort to locate MIAs and POWs, and still distrust the government's word, consider Webb one of their own. Johnny, just the name, without rank or position, is legendary in the POW-MIA community. Ann Mills Griffiths, who serves as executive director of the National League of POW-MIA Families for 33 years, wrote in a tribute to Webb that was read at his recent retirement ceremony in Hawaii. "Not just the Vietnam War," she continued, "but all wars back to World War II, and sometimes even further back into our history." Dr. Thomas Holland, the gregarious former lab chief who himself has been part of the MIA recovery effort for more than 30 years, recalled some of the ups and downs that Webb guided him through in a job that has never lacked for adventure or disappointment. I hired and fired anthropologists with Johnny, Holland said in his own tribute. I attended funerals with Johnny. I talked with angry family members in public and private settings with Johnny. And I briefed uninformed congressmen in D.C. with Johnny. I cussed out generals and left Johnny to smooth things over afterward. I drank gin and tonics at family updates with Johnny. I went to Cambodia where the Khmer Rouge threatened to kill us with Johnny. And I went to the league meetings where Ann Mills Griffith threatened to kill us with Johnny. No one deserves more credit for making the POW/MIA issue a national one, Holland said. Thousands of men have come home to their families because of him. This is as good and sound a legacy as any man can hope to have. In 1968 and 1969, perhaps the deadliest period of the Vietnam War, Army First Lieutenant Johnny E. Webb, Jr. was a logistics officer running supply convoys near the Cambodian border. We'd get ambushed by the Vietnamese, he recalled. Of course, a great target is a 5,000-gallon tanker with all that fuel in it. But fortunately, during the time I was there, we only lost one man. By 1975, as the Americans were completing their ignominious withdrawal from Southeast Asia, Webb's organizational skills landed him an assignment in Thailand as the operations officer of the Army Central Identification Laboratory, which was established to identify fallen service members from the conflict. Webb was ultimately put in charge of moving the lab in 1978 from Thailand to its current location in Hawaii, when the communist governments of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia blocked access to search teams. So Webb pushed to expand the search to other battle zones from earlier wars. In 1978, he led one of the first recovery missions to Papua New Guinea to bring home the remains of missing World War II flyers. We were warned when we went down there, Webb said, of the early missions to New Guinea. He was told that tribes could exact deadly revenge for any damage to their land or property. Over the years, Webb also made 24 trips to North Korea to negotiate with the reclusive regime, whose lack of cooperation in locating Allied dead from the Korean War is one of the most frustrating chapters in the annals of MIA recovery effort. Sometimes they lived up to the agreement, sometimes they didn't, he told me. We wanted to go to the POW camps. They wouldn't let us do that. By the early 1980s, Webb was running the entire MIA recovery effort when the U.S.'s former adversaries in Southeast Asia began to relent. There was a period of time we were going every other month, taking information in, records in, to share with the Vietnamese, he said. Webb led the first MIA recovery mission into Vietnam in 1985, and steadily managed to secure more personnel and funding for the mission. He enlisted troops with a broader range of skills, from explosives experts to help navigate battlefields and crash sites littered with leftover bombs, to mountaineering specialists to rappel down treacherous hillsides to carry out more recoveries in more places. And he hired additional anthropologists, scientists, historians, and genealogists. The advance of forensic science, combined with more regular access to some of the world's most remote locations, has increased the pace of successful recoveries in recent years, with nearly 1,300 identifications since 2015 alone. In 1994, when Webb retired from active duty as a lieutenant colonel on a Friday, he returned to work the following Monday, this time as a civilian employee. He has remained ever since, filling in a series of top posts, and has become a mentor for generations of military officers, enlisted personnel, and scientists who have toiled alongside him. And multiple times a year, he led gatherings like the one in Denver, where he methodically briefed dozens of families on the status of the searches. Webb deferred to the Pentagon analyst to go over the latest for Jane Addams on the search for her husband. Another excavation took place last March at the crash site in Laos that is believed to be where Captain Kligner was shot down. one of the numerous visits to the area dating back more than 15 years. This time, the recovery team found some of Klingner's personal gear, including an ID located roughly 30 feet from the cockpit area of the wreckage. It was a strong indication, the family was told, that Klingner went down with the plane. The recommendation was to continue the excavation in the future, one of the analysts reported. It was not exactly what Adams wanted to hear after all these years. Does that make Mike's case a higher priority, she asked. I'll step in and answer that, Webb interjected. Yes, fair enough. We know exactly who was lost there. We still have got to get in there as quickly as possible now and complete the excavation of the area that we've started. She still sounded weary, remarking that Webb previously told her about the impact of budget cuts. We didn't have enough money to put teams in for Vietnam and Laos for 3 or 4 quarters, he acknowledged, explaining that Congress' repeated delays in passing annual appropriations bills had delayed the agency's ability to mount all the missions it had planned. Okay, so it's still worth lobbying, she said. Absolutely, absolutely, he said. I'm glad you asked that question. Yes. For years, Webb has kept a talisman on his desk in his Hawaii headquarters from one of the Vietnam cases he worked so long and hard on. The father became very bitter, Webb related. I said, look, you can't give up hope. At some point, we're hopeful of bringing him back. The father didn't want to hear it. He would say to me, Johnny, I gave my son to the Army. I want my son back. I don't want any damn bones. Some years later, his son's remains were recovered, and the family needed more than a little convincing to burying him with full military honors in a national military cemetery. 2-3 weeks after that, Webb recounted, this little brown envelope shows up in the office. It was a note from the father to this effect. Johnny, I just want to thank you for all you've done for us over the years and let you know what it really meant to me to get my son back. And tucked inside was the POW/MIA bracelet the father had been wearing for decades with his son's name engraved on it. This was adapted from a story originally published in Politico. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The songwriter who crafted complex classics, Burt Bacharach, 1928-2023. The easy listening label attached to Burt Bacharach's music belied a world of complexity. Though catchy and hummable songs such as Walk On By, I Say a Little Prayer, and Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head featured lush orchestration, stark key changes, and unusual time signatures. Frank Sinatra once grumbled that Bacharach writes in hat sizes, 7 3/4. Yet more than 1,000 recording artists couldn't resist tackling the intricacies of Bacharach's work, which included 73 top 40 hits. The results were unforgettable and often, as in his 3 Oscar-winning theme songs, vividly cinematic. His one self-imposed rule, he said, was, don't make it difficult for the listener, just the singer. The son of a fashion columnist father and an amateur pianist mother, Bacharach became a skilled pianist by age 8, said the Times. As a teenager in the affluent New York suburb of Forest Hills, he was a jazzed fiend, sneaking off to Manhattan and using a fake ID to see Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker play. After Army service in the early 1950s, he accompanied touring musical acts until a fateful meeting with lyricist Hal David, who had become his writing partner. The two scored their first major breakthrough with 1962's Don't Make Me Over, performed by then-unknown backup singer named Dionne Warwick, and went on to write her 19 more hits. Throughout the 1960s, anything Bacharach and David touched became the commercial gold dust, said The Guardian. But a 1973 creative dispute triggered a spate of lawsuits, and the duo broke up. Bacharach's Magic Touch only returned in the early 1980s, when a partnership with lyricist and third wife Carol Bayer Sager yielded hits such as Arthur's Theme, Best That You Can Do, and That's What Friends Are For. A darkly handsome symbol of the shag carpet era, said the Washington Post, Bacharach made a winking cameo in 1997's Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery and its two sequels. He collaborated with the likes of Dr. Dre and Elvis Costello well into the 21st century and remained to the end a social creature. The pain that people go through, or the boredom, or the broken relationships, or the illnesses, music can be a powerful antidote, he said in 2013. And you don't get to see that just sitting in a room writing by yourself. On the cross page, we have a business column. Search Wars, Google's new challenge from AI. Google showed off its homegrown rival to the AI chatbot ChatGPT last week, said Sam Schimner and Miles Krupa in the Wall Street Journal. And Bard, as it's been named, may have given the most expensive wrong answer ever on a science quiz. In response to a question about the James Webb Space Telescope, Bard said that the telescope had taken the very first pictures of an exoplanet outside the solar system, which is simply untrue. The first pictures of an exoplanet were taken by another telescope in 2004. Shares in Google's parent company, Alphabet, promptly fell 7.7%, erasing about $100 billion in value. It was an inauspicious start for Google in the high-stakes war over the commercial potential of generative AI. AI-powered searches poses existential question for Google, said Richard Waters and Mutamita Mugia in Financial Times. By creating real competition, it threatens to demolish the high profit margins that have underpinned Google's core business. Microsoft, a cornerstone investor in ChatGPT, creator OpenAI, has already integrated the AI technology into its Bing search engine. Microsoft poured billions of dollars into challenging Google in the early days of search, but could not make a dent in its dominant position. Now, though, AI threatens to turn the tables, and Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella says that the Seattle giant is willing to do whatever it takes to even the playing field, even if AI-powered search means less advertising, less time searching, and less money across the board. In my early testing, the OpenAI-assisted Bing is smart. Really smart, said Joanna Stern in the Wall Street Journal. The searchers gave me a clear answer and saved me time on questions like, do you know if Beyoncé is touring? That said, Microsoft has ground to make up. To make sure Bing's answers were accurate, I resorted to an old habit. I checked Google. The search wars haven't been this hot since 2009, said Davey Alba in Bloomberg. Google sees that its near monopoly is finally under threat. Google executives have described perfecting search as the biggest moonshot for the company despite being nearly 25 years into the business. But it's not clear whether any of the new products really transform search or just show off a cheerful, seemingly fluent AI interface whose novelty will wear off. The accelerated rollouts of these products appear to be motivated less by their readiness than by FOMO, fear of missing out. No one truly knows what AI firepower Google may or may not be sitting on, but it looks like it's falling behind, said Richard Nieva in Forbes. Now it's forced into making trade-offs to catch up. Google has even said that it's willing to increase the risk it takes in bringing the technology to market. A stunning admission for a big tech company so closely scrutinized for toxic content. Google's awkward launch is a prescient example of the danger of relying on AI models, said Matthew Sparks, a New Scientist. Whether Microsoft or Google wins the race, poorly controlled AI search can open up new possibilities for creating misinformation on a mass scale. On the Talking Points page, we'll start with the article, Entitlement Reform, Why Doing Nothing Isn't an Option. A long-standing truism in Washington is that Social Security and Medicare are the third rail of American politics, said Lindsay Wise in the Wall Street Journal. Touch them at your peril. As a heated exchange between President Biden and House Republicans last week showed, any talk of cuts or changes to those programs remains politically explosive. During his State of the Union address, Biden asserted that some Republicans want Social Security and Medicare to sunset. A reference to a proposal by Senator Rick Scott, the Republican from Florida, that would require every federal program, including entitlements for seniors, to expire unless it is reapproved by Congress every 5 years. When Biden's statement drew boos from Republicans and a shout of liar from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, Biden leaned into the exchange. We all apparently agree. Social Security and Medicare is off the books, he said. Republicans were forced to applaud, and delighted Democrats praised Biden for cunningly trapping the congressional GOP into taking entitlement reform off the table. But Biden's gambit enraged Republicans, who said he was misrepresenting their position. That's not quite true, said Eric Cortalesa in Time. Yes, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and other GOP leaders have distanced themselves from Scott's plan. Still, Biden was not exactly elevating a fringe GOP idea. Last year, a GOP advisory committee called for raising the eligibility age for Medicare from 65 to 67 and for Social Security from 65 to 69. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, has said in the past that he wants to pull Social Security up by the roots and get rid of it. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a likely 2024 GOP presidential contender, has previously floated privatizing Social Security and restructuring Medicare. Republicans have spent decades trying to eviscerate these programs, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan proposed major Social Security cuts before backing down amid a political backlash. And in the 1990s, Newt Gingrich threatened to shut down the government while demanding major Medicare cuts. Then President George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security in 2005. When Paul Ryan became House Speaker in 2010, he pushed to turn Medicare into a voucher system for private insurance. Since Donald Trump transformed the GOP into a populist movement of mostly older voters, neither party has been willing to discuss entitlement reform, said Jeff Stein in the Washington Post. That's a shame because the inescapable fact is that both Social Security and Medicare are facing financial insolvency in the not-distant future. One of Medicare's trust funds is due to run out by 2028, leading to mandatory cuts in payments to doctors and hospitals that will jeopardize access to care, according to the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. By 2034, Social Security will be spending more than it collects, triggering an estimated 20% cut in benefits to millions of seniors. Given that reality, said Eric Bohm in Reason, promising to do nothing about the fiscal train coming down the tracks is a bipartisan suicide pact. Both programs can be fixed, said Zachary B. Wolf and CNN.com. Social Security's trustees have recommended raising the payroll tax that funds the program, reducing benefits for future beneficiaries by 24%, or some combination of those measures. Other ideas floating around, including raising the cap on income subject to Social Security tax, currently $160,200, so high earners contribute more, and denying Medicare benefits to the wealthy. But the longer lawmakers wait, the more complicated that math becomes. Meanwhile, Republicans say they're serious about attacking the deficit in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, but their promise to pare back spending without touching entitlements, defense, or veterans' benefits seems mathematically impossible. To balance the budget in 10 years while leaving these programs intact would require cutting 85% of other spending, estimates the CRFB. Polls show that reform Americans favor most is raising the payroll tax cap, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. We approve and would also consider raising the retirement age and revisiting how inflation is calculated each year to raise benefits. The problem is that doing any of these things requires a substantive political conversation that neither side seems willing to have. Both parties have even ruled out creating a bipartisan commission that would make recommendations. Meanwhile, 2024 candidate Trump has released a video urging House Republicans not to cut a single penny of entitlement spending. In a nation deeply divided along partisan lines, inaction on the biggest budgetary and retirement policy challenging facing our country may be the sole point of agreement. That article ran a little long, but we'll sneak in a quote from George Will, who says, "Football combines two of the worst things in American life. It is violence punctuated by committee meetings." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.